Position number 13041, rule 2.
Brigadier Warren, rule 2.
Well, we were on the side of the road very soon and opened fire on the Germans, particularly with our handheld anti-tank weapons, which was a weapon called a Piat, which fired a substantial bomb. And the Germans tried to dismount, of course, from their vehicles, and they became a very good target. And we had a short, sharp battle with them. And fortunately, I had a mortar that had got off, and they tried to go up the hill, and so we could mortar them as they went up the hill. And at the same time, we captured quite a lot of them on the road. And I remember that incident because my company headquarters was right on the road, and I was there. They'd captured these Germans. And one or two of them were very truculent. They were spitting at us and using some filthy British language that they'd picked up. And they were very insulting. I thought this was extraordinary because they must have realized that it wasn't the moment to antagonize the British. I mean, we might have turned on them. And in fact, one or two, I think, of the soldiers were inclined to do just that.
Did they start to hit them?
To hit them, yes. And anyway, I stopped any question of doing them real injury, but they appeared to ask for it. And it would not have surprised me if there had been some shooting, because in Sicily there had been some incidents where our people, the Canadians in this case, in an orchard, found that their prisoners had been hanged in an orchard. And of course this stirred them up a lot. And of course feelings run very high in a war, as you can imagine. And this was an incident that might have gone wrong. However,
Did there seem to be any specific reason for the reaction of these German POWs?
No, I can't say that I can see it. I think they were just very truculent, aggressive Germans. But anyway,
what kind of unit did they come from?
They were Panzer Grenadiers, I think. Obviously, they were surprised, I think, and they realized that they'd been given a pretty hard knock, and they didn't want to admit it. And I think this was what caused them to be so truculent. But anyway, they were evacuated back, the German prisoners, and we continued to climb up the hill where we had to get to the top of it, our objective. And we had inflicted casualties on them because we found some bodies of the Germans up the hill that had been killed or wounded by our mortar, the one mortar we had. We got to the top of the hill, I suppose, about 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, where we proceeded to dig in. And we were overlooking then, of course, the sea, and looking forward. That is, in a westerly direction. And we could see there was a cemetery with a lot of cypress trees, I remember. These cypress trees seemed to be everywhere. They always indicated a cemetery, usually. But I could see that. And we were getting no interference from the Germans. I mean, we were able to dig in and prepare ourselves in a defensive position. But then, later in the day, we had these unfortunate attacks that occur in a war. I think they call them friendly fire, and or they do now. In the Gulf War, they did. And we were attacked by American warhawks, who must have mistaken us. So after getting a stropping up from them, we suddenly observed in this cemetery some movement, and we could see German troops clearly getting ready for an attack. And it was very interesting that the Germans carrying out this attack, they were only wearing their trousers. They weren't wearing shirts, but they had ammunition belts around them, and their steel helmets on.
Did the American planes cause any casualties?
Not as far as I know. But anyway, the Germans were forming up for this attack very clearly. And of course we had this terrific OP. We were looking down on them. So our mortar came into business again. And we were able to open fire with our weapons on the cemetery area, which broke up the attack. It never took place. They withdrew, and we never saw them again. So that was it, and we stayed the night there without interference. And the following morning, we started to march along the road, going up towards Salerno, which was somewhere away, but the idea was that we were then, as a part of the 5th Division, that we should get up to Salerno, where they were having rather a sticky time. And we started the march, where we had no opposition. The Germans had gone, clearly. They'd gone back to Salerno, too. And when we were going along this road, after a couple of days, we were suddenly told that we would halt and that we were going back to Sicily. And we were going back to Sicily as a brigade, 231 Brigade, to join the 50th Division, which was going back to the UK to take part in the landings in Northwest Europe. So we went back to Sicily, where we were encamped in some orchards outside Catania. Then we actually got into Catania. I remember my company was in what had been a hospital, and later we moved by a transport to Augusta, where we joined a convoy going back to England with the 50th Division.
What was your company in Italy and Sicily?
C Company.
Were they mostly composed of Hampshire men?
Oh, yes. Very much so. Because we had a very high regular content in 231 Brigade, as a matter of fact. But in the first Hampshires, they had come back from India to Palestine just about the outbreak of war. And after going to the Western Desert for a short time, they were sent to Malta. And as they had come from India at the start of the war, they had a very high regular content, a lot of regulars. And they were Hampshire men, of course, the regulars. And we also had some of the Horbelisha call-up men that had been called up just before the start of the war. And they were practically all Hampshire men.
Did you find much difference in performance and soldierliness between the regulars and the non-regulars?
No, not really, no. I think those that weren't regulars, those that were, I forget what they called them. They were called up by a militiaman. They were very good, and they picked it up very quickly, and they were very good soldiers, I found. And I was sorry that in the course of the war that we lost so many of them. But they were very good. And, of course, having a high regular content meant that we had more older men rather than those that had been called out for the war. And so they were a very soldierly a collection of men in my company, I'd say that, with a very splendid company sergeant major who won the DCM and the MM, who was absolutely fearless. Anyway, I mean, we were there, and we were going back to England, and that was very good news for most of us, particularly the regulars that had come from India originally, and then they'd been in Palestine, and then they'd been in the Western Desert, and then in Malta. So they would be very glad to get back. And we sailed in this convoy, and I don't think any great excitement. I believe there was some excitement once. There were some depth charges dropped. We finally landed up in the Firth of Clyde at Gourock, where we disembarked. And we were told we were going to be stationed in Suffolk, at a place called Long Melford.
I think from then on we've recorded the rest in our previous interview.
You have. I would just like to say this little story. That, of course, in Sicily, our dress was khaki drill. And when we came back to England, of course, it was battle dress. And we had spent a lot of money in the battalion getting on the divisional signs and the various other things which we should wear. We had the 50th divisional sign, TT, three red bars for the 3rd Brigade, and the Malta a Brigade sign, which was a white cross on a red background. We had these all neatly sewed on by a seamstress, I think in Sicily. So we looked very smart, and the first thing that happened, we were told to take them all off for security reasons. So they all had to be cut off. And when we got to Long Melford, they all had to be sewn on again. I remember that. It was infuriating, but that's the way of the world.
Whilst you were in Sicily and Italy, did you have very much contact with the civilian population?
Well, I suppose we did, yes. The farmers and that sort of thing. I mean, we used to get wine from them, and of course there was a great deal of fruit there, grapes and figs and that sort of thing. We used to get them from the civilians, who were only too pleased to produce them. And particularly if you were fortunate with them, you might get a chicken for a change of diet. Generally speaking, after the campaign was over in Sicily, we'd had compo rations. That was tinned rations. And some of them were rather good. You got steak and kidney pudding and all sorts of things like that. But then when it was over, we went on to dry rations, which consisted mainly of bully beef, rice, and things like that. So the diet was pretty monotonous. Of course, on the ship coming home, we lived very well, because the ships always seemed to have a lot of good food on them.
What was the attitude of the civilians in general towards...
Well, the attitude of the civilians, I think they were glad to get out of the war, or they were on the point of getting out of the war. They'd had enough of it, and I think they preferred the British to the Germans, to be quite frank.
Did any of the Italian soldiers fight strongly?
Well, in Sicily, yes. I remember they did fight. We had to cross the River Detano, and I remember we did it at night, and moving up towards this attack, we came under very heavy artillery fire from the Italians. We didn't know it was the Italians then, but we soon found out. They showed every sign of defending as best they could. But as soon as we really got into them, they surrendered in large numbers. We captured 600 prisoners in one night in this attack. And they were all very fed up with the war. And I remember my batman had a very unfortunate pair of boots that was coming to pieces, and he was always complaining to me about this, and we were trying to get him a new pair. So I said, well, here's your big chance. Just go round and find an Italian that has a nice pair of boots. They did have good boots. And tell him that he has to take them off and give them to you, and you can give him yours. Rather curious, these Hampshire soldiers, this one. He was a real Hampshire soldier, too. What we would have called a Swede. And he didn't like to do that. In fact, he never did it. And I remember the next time he complained, I said, it's your fault. You could have had a nice pair of Italian boots, but you didn't take the opportunity.
So he had moral scruples.
He had moral scruples, yes. Far more than most, I think.
By a Swede, what exactly did you mean by that?
Well, I think the Hampshires have always been closely associated with the Swede, and even now, at dinners and that sort of thing, usually someone goes round with a Swede on a pole. And I think they're called Swedes, really, because that's a sort of agricultural vegetable which relates to Hampshire. And so they were, we used to call them Swedes. And I remember this chap, Private Cooper, the batman, he was a very broad, had a very broad accent.
I do remember once interviewing a soldier who served, I think, with the Royal Fusiliers, who was a Cockney himself, who was in cantonments in India, who referred to what he described as Swede regiments. I suppose he meant county regiments from agricultural areas.
Very probably, yes. But in our brigade, you see, we were Devons, Dorsets and Hampshires. And they're very agricultural regiments, really. I mean, they tend to come from the land as opposed to the towns or the cities. And of course, in the case of the Hampshires, we always had some from Portsmouth and Southampton. But that was an interesting point, which I could have mentioned earlier, that on the troop ship coming from Port Said to Sicily at Tranto. We'd had the names. We'd named the troop decks instead of numbering them. We'd named them, and they were called Winchester, Rumsey, Southampton, Portsmouth, and so on. So if you said, what troop deck are you on? The soldier would say Portsmouth or Winchester. And we found that was a rather curious psychological thing, that the having the names of towns that they all knew, in a way, it was comforting to them in the middle of a war. I think it brought memories back to some of them, probably.
We quite often hear about the supposed characteristics of regiments from different parts of the country, like the supposed characteristics of Highland regiments and the DLI and so on. Do you think there's any truth in this from your own personal experience?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And leaving aside my regiment for a moment, the Highland regiments, and particularly I think I would refer to the Black Watch, that I believe they could always recruit all the soldiers and officers that they needed to man that regiment. Now, that the Highland regiments, of course, are very clannish, and I think they get a feeling of closeness because of that. And I remember General Christensen, I heard him on the television. He was in the First World War, a Cameron Highlander. And he was telling this story, that he was a second lieutenant, in World War One in the trenches, and they were going to go over the top. And he could see that they were not in very good shape. They were not in very good form. And he began to wonder if they were going to go over the top. So he said, I began to sing the March of the Cameron Men. And that spurred them on, he said. They took it up. And when the time came, over they went. So I think it means a lot, and particularly the DLI, I think, who are mostly miners, I think they were a splendid regiment. And they all knew each other very well. And they had this common factor that most of them had been miners too, which gave them, I think, some degree of closeness. And to get back to the Hampshires, of course, I think we've always been a bit different to a northern regiments and that sort of thing, because they're being a farming stock and so on in the main. They are very easy to get on with, and they don't get very excited. But when they get into something like a battle, they'll fight very well. But probably the northern regiments, some of them, I think they are more liable to get excited, perhaps, than the Hampshires. And they're a very decent lot of people too in my regiment, and I've always known that in peacetime, where we had quite a lot of Hampshire men, because it was concerned with national service. And I remember in Jamaica, when I was commanding the battalion and we were leaving the Caribbean, the last British troops to be there, I got a letter from a lady who said, I would like you to know this, that my car broke down the other day on a road which was rather quiet and off the beaten track, and a Land Rover came along from your regiment, stopped, the driver got out, came across to me and said, can I help you with your car? And she said, yes, it's broken down. He proceeded to put her car right. And she said, I wanted to say what a nice man he was, so well-mannered. And I think this is rather typical of them.
When you mentioned that case of atrocity with the lynching of POWs in the orchard, how did you get to know about that?
Well, on the battlefield, of course, a rumor travels fast, or stories travel fast, and I expect we got it from the Canadians, because we were in under the command of the Canadian division, and various sort of tanks and various troops of theirs would be pretty nearby.
Could you tell me when you were in Aden after the war, please?
I went to out to Aden in the summer of 1964, where I was posted to be Area Commander East. As a result of the uprising in the Radfan earlier that year, the tribesmen in the west of Saudi Arabia, or some of them, had risen up in revolt. And as a result of that, we had to reinforce the garrison in the Radfan of Saudi Arabia. And I went out there to take on a new appointment. My appointment was to be the area commander, and I would wear the badges and buttons and so on of the Federal Regular Army, because that would give me the power of command over them. And also, of course, because I was a full colonel then in the British Army, I had full command over the British troops out there Now, I went out there, and the first thing I had to do was to learn Arabic. I was sent to a school in Aden to learn Arabic, which I did, colloquial Arabic. And I was quite amused by this. I did the course. I passed out second on the course, so I knew I hadn't done too badly. And the first thing they did with us afterwards, after the course was over, or just as it was ending, was to take us into Saudi Arabia so we could talk to some of the Bedouin. And I was primed up with my Arabic, and I remember going up to this Bedouin who was grinning all over his face. And in a very short time, it became clear that I couldn't understand what he was saying, and he couldn't understand what I was saying. It took some little time to get used to it, and by the time I'd spent 2 years out there, I could speak it pretty fluently, but it comes with practice. And having done the Arabic course, I went up to my headquarters, which had been set up near a place called Beihan, which was on the right on the frontier with the Yemen. And a lot of the explosives and arms and weapons and things getting into Saudi Arabia and Aden at that time were coming from the Yemen. And it always struck me as very amusing there that you would see a caravan with the riders riding along. They all had a transistor radio which they had attached to the saddle of the camel, listening to Sana radio, which was in the Yemen. And of course, if they could get Cairo radio, they would have that. And I think the FRA on their transistor radio is very often tuned into it, because you would hear some interesting bits of information. I was told that they were offering several thousand reals for anyone that would murder me. So we had that. And of course, Saudi Arabia was then governed by the newly formed federal government, that is the British, who decide that Saudi Arabia should be independent, and the rulers, the sultans, would form the federal government. And the federal government was supposed to control the Federal Regular Army, which to a certain extent they did. Of course, they had to rely greatly on the British, because the whole of the arrangements in Saudi Arabia, military arrangements, were based on the air, the supplies, and the hunters with the ground attack aircraft, which they used to use from time to time. So we had Aden, which was by and large in a state of revolution, but that was separate, as far as the government went, to Saudi Arabia. It was a separate entity, and Aden was a colony ruled by the British. Of course, a substantial revolution was taking place there, but I didn't have anything to do with what went on in Aden. I was concerned with what went on in South.